pledge of endless life above.
Be seated, please.
Would you please read with me Matthew, the 16th chapter, verses 24 through 26. Then Jesus told his disciples, "If any man would come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. For whoever would save his life will lose it, and whoever loses his life for my sake will find it. For what will it profit a man if he gains the whole world and forfeits his life? Or what shall a man give in return for his life?"
Thank you, Jimmy, for reading that text. During the prayer, I thought of something that had been said years ago that made me appreciate our getting together on occasions such as this. Someone said, "We do not come together to worship. We come to worship together." Now, there's a great difference. Do you see the difference? We don't come together to worship, but we do come to worship together. The Christian spends his week worshiping, reveling in the goodness and the majesty and the love of God. And your thoughts, either consciously or unconsciously, are centered upon the greatness of our Father. That is worship. And then on Lord's days, we all come together, having spent a week of worshiping apart from each other, we all come together to raise voices together and praise our God together. Now that's meaningful to me, and I think maybe it will be to you. Cecil Beck was back in the service today at the first service. I know you'll be glad to hear that. Cecil's been out for a good long while. We have so many people who are new also who are here. We had a lot of students. Not that students aren't people, I don't mean that, but there are a lot of resident people who have come and who have moved here, and a lot of students that are here. And though contrary to the way it looks when they move here, they're not really permanent. Some of them, though, bring enough with them that it looks like they're permanent, but they're just here for about 4 years. But we're glad you're here. And on behalf of the elders and all of the congregation here who are old and settled in and mellowed, we welcome all of you new people to our midst. We're so glad to have you. May I urge you to, in order to get settled in and get to be with us, would you take the initiative and invite the rest of us into your homes? Sometimes it takes that in order to finally break through and make yourself known. It shouldn't be like that, but sometimes it is. But anyway, we're glad that you're here, and we hope that your stay is pleasant and profitable. There's an advertisement that you hear a lot about on TV, and it goes like this. You go around only once, get all the gusto you can. And that's a philosophy that every last one of us here today subscribes to. There's not a one of you that does not, knowingly or unknowingly, subscribe to this concept. I want to be happy, and I want to get all out of life that I possibly can. The problem lies in finding the answer to the question, how do you go about it? And the pursuit of the answer to that question has occupied more people for more hours than any other one single question that has ever been asked to the human race. Now you mark my word, the answer to the question, how do you go about getting the most out of life, is the question that could be termed the eternal, perennial, universal question that is asked by everyone. There are two philosophies. They are poles apart. The two philosophies that answer this question. Some people are saying you get it like this. Others are saying, no, you get it like this. Both of these philosophies are found in what Jimmy just read as the text. Jesus said, if any man would come after me, let him deny himself, take up his cross and follow me. But then he mentions the other philosophy. He that loves his life will lose it. And then he mentions his own philosophy, but he that loses his life for my sake shall find it. Now, in those two very simple statements, you have the two most preoccupying philosophies that men and women deal with in their lives. He that loves his life loses it. He that loses his life for my sake finds it. Now, the first one of these philosophies I've illustrated on this chart behind me by the small upright triangle. It's the philosophy of the world. It's the philosophy that is described, as I say, somewhat in detail here. It's defined very distinctly in 1 Corinthians, the 15th chapter and verse 32, where Paul said, as he quotes what those who follow this philosophy say, let's eat and drink because tomorrow we die. This philosophy is born of futility. It's nourished in frustration. This philosophy, put into modern language, mouthed by a youth of our day, whom someone saw living a life of dissipation, complete abandonment, asked him, son, what in the world are you doing? And this youth, because of his lack of faith in God and his having no hope, said very accurately of his own philosophy, as long as you're on the Titanic, you might as well go first class. Well, this philosophy is known to us as hedonism. It is the pursuing of pleasure and physical gratification as an end in itself. It's looked upon as being the chief pursuit of life. It's considered to be the summum bonum. It's considered to be the highest good. And there are people by the multiplied millions that have no greater purpose in life than to pamper the flesh. That becomes the end goal of their life. That's what is known as hedonism. It is a triangle that we refer to as an upright triangle. Broad at the base, but it is a philosophy that is of diminishing returns. It is a philosophy that if you continue to pursue it, each day becomes the frustration of a goal that is more earnestly pursued, with the result that there is diminishing enjoyment attached to it. God defines it in Galatians, the 6th chapter, where he says, God is not mocked. Whatever a man sows, that shall he reap. He that sows to the flesh shall from the flesh reap corruption. That defines the philosophy. The Apostle Paul gives the prognosis also in Romans, the 8th chapter and verse 13, when he said, he who lives according to the flesh shall die. That cannot be misunderstood. He doesn't back off and try to make it more palatable. He does not try to soften the blow. He just simply says, he that lives according to the flesh shall die. He says earlier the same thing. But in verse 13, he says, if you live according to the flesh, you will die. That's true whether it was spoken to Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden. That's where they made their mistake. They answered the question, this perennial, eternal, universal question, they answered it wrongly. They answered it by saying, you get the most out of life by satisfying the demands of the flesh. But whether they answered it right or wrong, God had already diagnosed it. He'd already given the prognosis when he says, the day you touch this fruit, you're going to die. Whether you go to Genesis and Adam and Eve or to the book of Revelation, where all liars and sorcerers and whoremongers and thieves and the covetous and all the others that are listed in that great listing that are standing outside the gates of the city, all of the way from Genesis through Revelation, this prognosis of this philosophy still stands. He that lives according to the flesh shall die. Now, you can illustrate it all through life. How many men have looked back over a life of wasted, spent years of youth, having lived a life of hedonism, having given themselves to a life of dissipation? How many have looked back over that with remorse and with emptiness and said, all that it has ever brought to me has finally come to be misery? There by the millions. How many have said, I have done everything that I have ever wanted to do, and I find that if there is nothing more in life than that, life is not worth living? And how many people have come to the end of their life unable to face the inevitability of such a philosophy, and having then despaired with the natural expiring of their life, have taken their life by their own hand in order to keep from enduring any further degradation that's been brought about by such a philosophy of self-indulgement or self-indulgence? He that lives according to the flesh will die. I once knew of a man like that. He had 1,000 wives, 700 wives and 300 concubines. He had every imaginable thing in life that should have brought pleasure. He had, if there had been available, he had stereo, except that he had the living thing. He didn't have the stereo and the records. He had the men singers and maid singers. He said, just as many as I wanted, whatever I wanted, and whatever my eyes saw, that's what I took. And he said, I did not withhold from myself anything that was pleasant. And after having gone through 1,000 marriages, he wrote this in his memoirs. Vanity of vanities, all is vanity, vexation of spirit. That wasn't done academically or philosophically. It wasn't done like having then spent 40 or 50 years enjoying to the fullness all the pleasures that 1,000 wives could bring an ordinary man. It wasn't then that he had his feet propped up on the couch and his pipe there, and all of the wives, you know, around him still, him writing his memoirs, vanity of vanities, all is vanity and vexation. Honey, how do you spell vexation? And 1,000 wives say V-X-S, you know, and they start spelling it. No, that's not the way it went. This man wrote this out of a hungering in his very being. He wrote it out of a sad realization that you don't get satisfaction like this. This man wrote it in the very midst of not being satisfied in something that is so very near his very being. He wrote it out of a cry from the inside. Vanity, vanity, vexation. You know what it means to vex somebody? It means to gouge and to pursue and to pester without there being any relief or release or satisfaction. That's to vex. And he said this pursuit that he had made literally had just actually caused him to itch more where he couldn't scratch. Did you ever think of what Romans, the first chapter, verses 18 through 32 meant? These people who had denied the existence of God, these liberated souls who had finally gotten rid of this illusion of divinity, this illusion of there being a deity. They had finally said, there isn't any God. Oh, and they were considered to be wise. They thought they were wise, and yet God said they were fools. And they changed the glory of the incorruptible God for the likeness of the image of corruptible man and four-footed beasts and creeping things. They had changed and denied the deity of God and had deified their own nature, their own personalities, their own being, along with that of birds and beasts. And then it says that because of this, that God gave them up to the lusts of their flesh. They turned to homosexuality. They turned to all the perversions of sex that you can see going about us today in the world. They turned to all of that. Man, they were so free. And they just went into all of this that they chose. You know, they didn't mind. They just had all of it at their disposal. And then there's a list of about 18 or 20 sins or things that, you know, that they were guilty of doing. And if you're not careful, you'll look at that and you'll think, man, look at that. Look at all those people, what all they're doing. That's right. But let me tell you something. This is not a role of pleasure, fulfilling enjoyments. That role of people there in Romans, the first chapter, is a list of people who are frantic to find out where it's at. And not finding where it's at, they find themselves grappling and grabbing and grasping and trying to find some expression of themselves to where they find some enjoyment and some peace, and to where this itch that they have by nature can finally be scratched. And not finding it in God, or not taking God and letting Him provide it, they then are cast upon their own inventions. And then Satan, who can't provide anything that's enjoyable, all he can do is take something that God has made that's enjoyable and then twist it or put it into a degree or put it beyond limits where God has said that's off limits. That's all Satan has going for him. And then he has enticed these unsteadfast souls and said real enjoyment is over on this side of the fence. You know, if you were to translate that down into what you might call a mechanical translation, you know how I would translate it? That since they refused to have God in their knowledge, God put them on an ever-increasing treadmill. You know what a treadmill is? Do you ever see a mouse on a treadmill? Boy, he's just running up a storm. Oh, he's there where the action is. Or rather, he's going through all the motions. But as far as the action, he doesn't have any satisfaction. He's going through all the motions, though, but he's not getting anywhere. People in the world today, like C.S. Lewis talked about, he says there is an, I want to quote what he said, there is an ever-increasing demand for an ever-diminishing pleasure. That the world, according to this philosophy, is an ever-increasing demand for an ever-diminishing pleasure. I got a letter last week from a man in New Zealand. A man with whom I spent hours, literally months, literally years, week after week. He's a prisoner. He has spent the majority of his life in prison. He spent the majority of his life on this kind of a philosophy, the one that's wide-based, but that finally comes to be nothing. He's at the point now of nothingness. He wrote me a letter, and it reminded me of something that he told me long ago. It was too late, really, for him. I think he's beyond the point of returning. Maybe not. Keep praying for him, and I'll keep praying for him. But he made this statement in regard to life and in regard to liquor, you know, maybe making you enjoy life, and as far as his own reputation among the women as being a woman's man and all this, and how liquor had to do with it. And he made this very astute observation. He said, Jim, alcohol only increases the desire. It does not increase the fulfillment. It only increases the desire. It does not increase performance. Just the desire. And to have an ever-increasing desire and at the same time a constantly diminishing ability to fulfill that desire is absolutely, to me, one of the most maddening conceptions of a predicament in life that you could possibly come to. How would you like to be continually hungrier and hungrier and hungrier and at the same time have a smaller and smaller and smaller mouth until finally there just wasn't any mouth and yet your hunger inside was killing you? That's what this philosophy does. Then there's the other philosophy, and that's the philosophy of Jesus Christ. The philosophy of Jesus says, he that loses his life for my sake shall find it. Jesus Christ says that you must begin at this point of zero. You must begin here. It's an inverted triangle. The Christian's life doesn't begin on a wide plane. It begins at point zero. It begins where Jesus said, blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. It begins here where Jesus said, the man that would come after me, let him deny himself, take up his cross, and follow me. Just prior to this statement, he had made known to his disciples that it was in the plan of God that Jesus himself had to, it was necessary for him to go to Jerusalem, be mistreated by the scribes and the Pharisees and the rulers, and be put to death, and then to be raised on the third day. That was the plan of God. Peter took him aside like you and I would have taken him aside, and we would have said, Lord, you're not going to do that. They're not going to do that to you. God forbid. It's not going to happen. Jesus rebuked him and said, get behind me, Satan. You're not on God's side. You're on man's side. In other words, Peter, you're not operating on God's philosophy. You're operating according to man's philosophy. Man's philosophy would have said, save your life. Jesus' philosophy said, you've got to give your life. Then the next verse, Jesus said, now, if any of you want to follow me, you'll have to also deny yourself, take up your cross, and follow me. He said it's not optional. This thing of denying of yourself, taking up your cross, and following me is not optional. He said it is inherent within discipleship. You don't become a disciple of Jesus without denying yourself, taking up your cross, and following him. That is precisely the heart of discipleship. And it's the heart of the philosophy of living. Now let me illustrate it. We illustrate it by this inverted triangle, where it begins at a very small point, at a minutia, and then expands to the very greatest heights and widths and breadths that human beings can experience. This is so seen so clearly in Jesus Christ in Philippians 2, 5 through 8, where it says that who, though being in the form of God, did not consider being on an equality with God a thing to be grasped selfishly, but he emptied himself, taking upon himself the form of a servant. Watch. Jesus Christ, it said, was actually in the form of God. But he didn't count that as being something that he would selfishly hold to himself. He was willing to empty himself and become a servant. And then God highly exalted him. That's the Christian's road also. Jesus says, if any man would come after me, let him do the same thing. But brethren, I find that it is so applicable and so perfectly demonstrated in all of life that it has become literally a philosophy that governs life. The other is a philosophy that determines death. But this philosophy is that which determines and governs life. Let me show you. It's good for business. I say it's good for business. This is the principle that governs business. In Luke, the 6th chapter, in verse 38, Jesus there says, give, and it will be given back to you. Good measure, shaken down, pressed together, running over, will men lay in your lap. Now he just says it's good business. It's good in personal relationships. Do you want to get a lot out of life? Then give of yourself to other people. Don't see how much you can get out of other people. See how much you can give to them. Jesus said it's a principle of life. If you do like that, your life will also be full. It will be enriched. They'll give you a good measure, pressed down, heaped up, shaken together, pressed together, running over, the whole thing will be yours. Look again. Are you a farmer? Well, over here, the man read at the table when we gave the collection in the 9th chapter of 2 Corinthians 6 through 9, he talks to farmers here. The point is this. He says, he who sows sparingly will also reap sparingly. He who sows bountifully will also reap bountifully. And in verse 8, and God is able to provide you with every blessing in abundance so that you may always have enough of everything and may provide an abundance for every good work. He talks about a principle here of farming. A farmer has two options. If he has 100 grain or 100 bags of grain, he can do one of two things. He can live it up that first year. Man, he can just absolutely live high on the hog because he can have absolutely all this that he wants. It's his. He can use it. Or he can take it and live modestly and moderately, and then he can sow the rest of that seed over all of his land and wait. Now, which is the wiser of the two? Well, you know, unless you're eating yourself into your grave. And a lot of people do that. I once knew a man, a Christian, fine man. He and his brothers, they were about four or five of these Cutts brothers. You may know of them, some of you, up in New Jersey. And he was a cranberry merchant and blueberries. And I'm telling you what, he got in on the ground floor, and he was making good money. And a lot of other men up there got into it on the same way and on the same floor, and they were making a lot of money. And I was there for a meeting 2 or 3 years, and he wanted me to see his cranberry bogs and his blueberry patches, and so I went by and looked at them. And he also took me around to see the homes of some of these other men who were also in that same business. And I'm telling you, you're talking about fantastic homes. They were absolutely beautiful. Huge mansions, I mean. The one where I was staying that belonged to John Cutts, it was amazing how it even stood up. It had no paint on it. It was an old two-story house that was probably 150 years old. It didn't even have any paint inside it that I can remember. It was just an old house. Do you know what he did with his income? He decided that he would take it and buy land with it and invest it and wait for the returns. And while all these other cats were out there burning up the trail, you know, and really burning up the woods, he was just quietly sitting there in that old house putting his money into these lands so that he could use that later on, and he would have all this return coming in. Now, that's what Christianity is about. That's the way your personal relationships work. That's the way your businesses work. That's the way farming works. It's just the way life works. Let me give you some illustrations now about everyday things. Some of you boys, young boys and girls that are here, all of you, do you know what this time in your life is for? Say if you're 4 to 10 or 12 or 14, you know what this time in your life is for? It's for listening to your mom and daddy and being in subjection to your mother and father. Children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right. Because notice what he says there, if you would have long life, if you would see good days and long life, you listen to your mother and daddy. But you say, that's too confining. Man, you don't know my mom and daddy. They're old fogey. And I can't go anywhere and can't do anything. It's all right, you listen to your mom and daddy. Now's the time that you learn 2 or 3 things. You learn to be in subjection to other people, which isn't bad. You learn respect for authority. You learn how to have some self-control. You don't have to have everything you know that you want. And your mom and daddy see that you don't get everything you want if they're wise. So what you do, and you learn all these things. Well, when are you going to learn that if you don't learn it as a child? Well, a lot of people never learn it, and they end up in the prison like that man in New Zealand. He never did learn that you couldn't get everything that you wanted. So right now, you see, your time of learning is being in subjection to your mom and daddy's. All right, then if you'll learn those lessons good, you know what's going to happen when you get to be teenagers and gone out past that? Well, your life is going to be liberated into such a liberated field of uncluttered and completely emancipated living that you're going to be just as free as a bird because you learned back here how to submit yourself to your mamas and daddies. Look again, those of you who are students here, who are college students, do you know what you're supposed to be doing right now in your age? Say 18, 17, 18 through 20 or 22 or 3 or 4 or 5. You know what you're supposed to be doing? Studying? No. Yeah, you're supposed to be studying. Sure, you're supposed to be studying it. And by the way, you better get it now, because the older you get, the harder it comes. But on the top of your studying and with your studying, you know what else is peculiar to your age? You're supposed to be courting. That's right. These are your courting years. And boy, enjoy it. You boys, get out there and take the initiative. And you girls, reciprocate. And get this thing, yeah, get it going. Don't wait till you're 45 or 50 to start courting. That's not what 45 and 50 is made for. If you wait till then to start courting, all you're going to be doing is sweating in the palms of your hand and breaking out in perspiration. You can't cope with courting at 45 and 50 if you've never done it before. It's hard on old folks. By the time you get to be 45 and 50, you know what you're supposed to be doing. You're supposed to be doing like Brother Gaines and Sister Gaines, enjoying your grandchildren. So get out there and start being what you ought to be doing and start doing that. Now, once you do that, but now watch, at the same time that you're supposed to be courting, you know what else goes along with it? Some of these restrictions that the world looks at and says, man, that's too restricting. That's too confining. Because the Bible teaches you to be pure in your courtship.
But the world just says, well, let's let it all hang out. Get all you can from as many as you can. And if you're not near the girl you love, love the girl you're near. It just doesn't make much difference. Get it all.
But the Bible makes this very unusual statement. Run from fornication. Run from it. Every other sin that a man commits is outside his body. But he who commits fornication sins against his body. Do you know what that says and what it means? It means that for a person to indulge in fornication, within the very act of that fornicating, that person is in that very action limiting himself to the enjoyment of that which God has provided. That the more you indulge in fornication and promiscuity, the more you are at the same time chopping off any ability to enjoy that thing until finally you get to the point of being frantic. Then you start looking into perverted areas. You start doing all these things that the devil can only provide, you see. But if you'll just use these years for what God intended it, then when you find Miss Perfect, by the way, you'll know how to conduct yourself toward her. When you find Mr. Perfect, oh, don't wait until that long. You go ahead and marry, even though you can't find him. He'll become that under your tutelage. But boy, when you do find him, watch what happens. Then your life together begins to be this triangle. If you'll use each year for what God intended it, right on down the years of life, it just gets broader and broader and broader till finally you don't understand how life could be so beautiful, provided you start at this point and let God provide the guidelines for your life. That's the philosophy of Jesus Christ. It's an inverted triangle. Well, you say it's too late for me. No, it's not. But you say, I've spent so many years living by this other philosophy of getting all I can get. It's not too late. You remember Jerry and Jack Davis, who were here some year ago and were with us about 2 years? Jerry had become a very bitter agnostic, very, very bitter. Jack was an alcoholic. Jack was off on one of his regular sprees. She didn't know where he was, hadn't seen him in months. In the meantime, she became a Christian through the efforts of one of her neighbors, a member of this congregation. She became a Christian. Jack called and said, what's up, what's new? When she said, I've become a Christian, he said, you a Christian? He said, I'm coming home. He got the next bus, came home, and within about a week or 10 days, he was a Christian. They struggled for some 2 or 3 years trying to grow up in the Lord, and then I received this letter from a mutual friend. I think Jack and Jerry have both put the past away completely. I don't believe either of them will ever drink again. They both went through a very intensive study for emergency medical treatment, EMT. It was a rough 90 hours of study and work, even for Jerry, who knew most of it. But would you believe that when they took the test, the final test of 6 hours length, they both made the exact same grade and came out at the top of the class. They now are both certified by the state as EMT, and Jack is now working at the hospital as orderly and ambulance driver. He's doing a great job. It's steady employment. He has the respect of all those that work at the hospital, nurses, doctors, and administrator. It's the first time that he's ever had a certificate of any kind, and he truly earned it. They both know that it would never have been possible without Jesus Christ. No, it's not too late. But I'll tell you what, those that live by the flesh, that you're going to die. It's those who renounce the flesh and who by the Spirit put to death the deeds of the body. These are the ones that are going to live. He that would love his life will lose it, but he that loses his life will save it. Now look, if you're here today and you're not a Christian, there's more to life than just cars. There's more to life than just food and clothes. God has a plan for you, but you're going to have to come on his terms. Would you come today and accept Jesus Christ as your Savior? Come in faith. Turn your back upon the philosophy that says self is the purpose for living. Turn yourself around and acknowledge the God that is your God. And he asks that you serve him through Jesus Christ. Come and be immersed in water for the forgiveness of those sins and then be raised to walk this new life, which is an ever-increasing life, and begin to enjoy what Jesus said when he said, I have come that they might have life and have it more abundantly. That's what he's got in store for you. if you'll just accept Him as Lord and put His philosophy into your life. Come on now, let's not put it off any longer. You need Him, and He's waiting for you now. Will you come while we stand and sing?